I do think it reflects very poorly on the way we treat Native Alaskans. That's always been an issue, that Americans don't treat Native Alaskans equally.
The Obama administration targets retirement funding for Territorial Guard members. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 25th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, polar bear biologists set off on a unique research expedition.
This study will provide a very information-rich window into polar bears' lives at an important time of the year that we haven't been able to see before.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The White House is taking aim at funding for pensions for Alaska Territorial Guard members who served during World War II. The Obama administration outlined its military spending priorities to the Senate today and listed a handful of things it opposes funding for. It objects to counting the Territorial Guard members' service during World War II as active duty. The Guardsmen were part of a militia formed during the war to protect the territory of Alaska from Japanese attacks. That service counted toward retirement pensions until earlier this year, when the Army decided it no longer would. That dropped the amount of money about 26 elderly Alaska Native men received through their retirement pensions by an average of $400 per month. Alaska senators got the funding reinstated in a defense appropriations bill now before Congress. That's what the White House objected to today, saying it would establish a precedent of treating services performed by state employees as active duty for purposes of retirement pay. But Alaska Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell says the White House has it all wrong. He says the men were not state employees.
To me, it appears that the Obama administration doesn't even understand what the Alaska Territorial Guard is. This really was an initiative of the federal government, and they provided a federal service, which was the protection of soil of the United States during war.
Campbell says the men were called on to serve without being paid, and Congress has since recognized them as veterans. He says this dishonors their service.
I think this is horrible because I do think it reflects very poorly on the way we treat Native Alaskans. That's always been an issue, that Americans don't treat Native Alaskans equally, with equal justice and equal equality. And these Alaskan Natives are now again being singled out, in my opinion, for their service. And so I think it's going to be received very poorly.
Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski reacted with disappointment and frustration at the administration's report today. Murkowski says she's surprised the White House singled out the Territorial Guard members' situation.
I said I'm disappointed, but I am a little bit bemused that they are bringing this up and are including it as one of just a handful of objections that they are citing to in the defense appropriations. So I think it is important that we go back to the administration, make very clear to them exactly what the history is.
Murkowski says despite White House objections, she thinks the Alaska delegation is still on track toward getting the men's pensions restored. She says it should help that the chairman of the powerful Appropriations Committee, Democratic Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, co-sponsored their measure.
The fact of the matter is we've got the language in the legislation right now, and that's the best position to be in. So in order to delete this, there has to be a motion to strike, and that's going to take some lobbying and some effort on behalf of the administration.
The White House would not comment today on the situation. State lawmakers passed a bill earlier this year filling the Guardsmen pay gap through February. Biologists are heading out tomorrow from Barrow to study polar bears in the Beaufort Sea from an icebreaker. The five-week research trip will mark the first time scientists have been able to study the bears in this environment at this time of year. Eric Regeer is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife polar bear biologist who will be on the icebreaker. He will be trying to recapture 20 bears who were outfitted with satellite collars during an earlier phase of the research project. He says this is the second year of a two-part study.
Last year, at the beginning and the end of the summer, we captured and recaptured polar bears on land on Alaska's north coast. The objective of that was to see what are polar bears doing on land during the summer. Are they eating? How are they moving? And just what is their behavior and ecology? This year, 2009, being the second year of the study, we originally captured about 20 polar bears in the spring off the north coast of Alaska on the sea ice. We took a suite of samples and measurements from these bears and fitted them with tracking devices. So we know where these bears have been over the course of the summer and where they are now. So our objective is to go out and recapture and reevaluate these 20 polar bears, most of which have spent the summer on the sea ice far north of the coast.
Of the 20 bears that you're hoping to capture, are they sort of staying together or do they range far away from each other?
If a polar bear could choose to be anywhere in the world, it'd be located on sea ice over the shallow and biologically productive waters of the continental shelf. And in the southern Beaufort Sea, that continental shelf is only about 70 miles wide. In the summers, however, the sea ice melts and retreats north into the polar basin. And so the bears can do one of two things. They can stay on land or they can stay on the pack ice as it moves north. And indeed, that's what most of the bears in this study have done, is remain on the pack ice as it retreats north and east toward the North Pole. And so the bears that we're tracking are pretty much lined up on that multi-year ice edge northeast of Alaska, about 100 to 500 miles offshore. And what they're doing is they're waiting for the ice to start refreezing and coming back south toward those nearshore productive habitats where they want to spend their time.
You mentioned that you tagged them last spring and then recaptured them a year ago.
Yeah.
What did you learn in that first season? What were the results of those studies?
Well, it was very interesting, and some of the data are still being analyzed, but we were really surprised at the wide variety of behaviors and activity levels that polar bears onshore exhibited. We had expected that polar bears would remain mostly sedentary and enter what we call a state of walking hibernation, where they basically lounge around on shore and live off their fat reserves. What we found, indeed, that some bears did do that, but a lot of the bears were very active along the coast during the summer. Several of the bears in the study that we looked at last year actually swam between the coast of Alaska and the multi-year pack ice. One bear spent almost 10 days in the water and traveled a distance of about 300 miles from the coast to the pack ice, then at the end of the summer came back down. Apparently that swim was very demanding on the bear because she lost about 25% of her body mass.
Is it known how far they can swim? It seems incredible, the distances that they can go.
You know, one thing to remember about polar bears is they require sea ice as a platform from which to access seals. They're not successful at jumping in the water and just catching a swimming seal. They're not as fast or as agile as the seals. On the other hand, polar bears are marine mammals. These are animals that are very comfortable in the water, and when they need to get from one ice floe to the other, they are capable of swimming distances of 10, 20, 50 miles. Although as the Arctic sea ice diminishes, as it has in recent years, one of the major concerns is that bears are going to have to do more and more swimming to get from ice floe to ice floe. And swimming is very energetically demanding and indeed a bit risky, especially for the younger bears in heavy seas or if there's a storm.
What type of insight do you think this phase of the research will give you into the Beaufort Sea polar bear population?
This study will provide a very information-rich window into polar bears' lives at an important time of the year that we haven't been able to see before. And hopefully this will allow us to understand just how sea ice loss is affecting polar bear populations and also allow us to develop more accurate predictions of how polar bears will respond to future sea ice loss. So, for example, in this study, by understanding the relative benefits to polar bears of spending the summer on the sea ice versus on land, hopefully, we can more accurately predict how many polar bears will be coming onto land in future years. And ideally, this will allow us to be proactive in developing strategies to minimize conflicts between bears on land and the human settlements and industrial development that occurs on Alaska's North Slope.
Eric Regeer is a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, two Germans win the trip of a lifetime to Unalaska, but there's a catch.
Pretty much all they said is like 10 days, two guys, 5,000 euros, and go for a really tough job far away.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Tuesday, October 6th is the REAACRSA election. Polling places are open from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Bring your voter registration card, your driver's license, or your tribal ID. If your name is not on the register, you may vote a question ballot. If you're unable to go to the polls, you may have a personal representative pick up a special needs ballot for you from the polling place. The election board can provide language or other assistance needed, or you may bring a person of your choice to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
The South Central Natural Gas Company, NSTAR, is hoping to get a gas supply agreement approved that would provide new gas supplies to existing customers and also bring in new customers in Anchor Point. The agreement is with Anchor Point Energy, and NSTAR has asked the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to expedite the request's approval. NSTAR spokesman John Sims says the company wants two things from the RCA: approval for a gas supply agreement and construction of a pipeline.
We've got to build a pipeline from Inilchik all the way down to Anchor Point. It's a transmission line, and it's going to run in excess of $20 million. And the first thing that has to happen, though, is we have to have that expedited approval because we need the 2010 construction year to get that pipe completed so we can get gas to markets to our customers in 2011.
Sims says NSTAR is excited about the gas supply agreement because it will help meet part of the looming gas shortage in 2011, and Anchor Point Energy has agreed to drill two additional wells over the next 4 years. But the supply agreement, if approved, will only meet about a tenth of NSTAR's needs.
We are still seeking contracts with other producers right now, hoping to supply or fill that gap, but it's something that we haven't been able to do as of yet.
Sim says there isn't much on the horizon for short-term solutions to the gas shortage problem, and NSTAR is hoping the RCA will approve the Anchor Point Energy Agreement by March 2010. The current and projected low prices in U.S. natural gas markets have not slowed down the two pipeline companies competing to carry North Slope natural gas to market. Both TransCanada, with its state license approved under AGIA, and Denali Pipeline, a partnership project of BP and ConocoPhillips, still expect to take their plans to potential producers next year. TransCanada's Vice President Tony Palmer says he will start the open season process by submitting information to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission at the end of January. Once that's approved, the report becomes available for bidders who want to use the project, with the process concluding in July. Denali's Director of Media and Communications, Dave McDowell, isn't ready to set a date yet, only saying the open season will be held sometime next year.
An open season is when the pipeline company solicits long-term, multi-billion-dollar shipping commitments from its customers. And in this case, the customers would likely include some of the North Slope natural gas leaseholders. They could be others as well.
The open season is an important step, but there's no guarantee Alaska will walk away with a project ready to go. Nor will either company speculate on the results of the openings. Neither would be surprised to see bids that have conditions attached. TransCanada's Palmer says that's just normal for large projects, and he's getting signals from potential bidders to expect conditional bids.
That is the norm, and it's also the norm that pipeline companies would then take a period of several months to work with those potential customers to see if they can resolve those conditions precedent. That's typical in the pipeline industry.
Palmer won't speculate on what the bid conditions might be, but McDowell says he's hearing the big issue is fiscal certainty. In other words, taxes on the gas.
They've said they need to understand what the rules are around gas taxation in order to have the confidence they need to make these, you know, multi-billion-dollar, multi-year shipping commitments that will be used to underpin pipeline financing.
Neither Denali nor TransCanada can address the stable tax issue, and so far there has been no indication of the subject coming before next year's state legislature. The Forest Service gave the final go-ahead Thursday to a controversial timber sale on Prince of Wales Island. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Regional forester Denny Beshore okayed the logjam sale southeast of Kaufman Cove. He turned down an appeal by the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, the Audubon Society, and the Alaska Wilderness League. Tongass Forest spokesman Ray Massey says Beshore determined Southeast Mills need the entire 73 million board foot sale to survive.
He emphasized that basically we need to have timber sales in order to keep the infrastructure for timber harvest in Southeast so we can do restoration work. We can thin those thousands of acres of young growth that are sitting out there that aren't, some of which aren't quite ready for harvest, and also to do stewardship work to restore some of these areas that have been harvested already.
The environmental group suggested cutting about half the proposed amount of timber. SEAC Conservation Director Buck Lindekugel says the appeal was a compromise offered in the spirit of cooperation.
Well, we had worked really hard to come up with a supply of timber for the mills and still address the long-term needs of the fish and the wildlife and the other forest users in the area. And this decision suggests that the Forest Service just wants to keep doing business, you know, the same old on the Tongass, and that's not meeting anybody's needs.
He says it's too early for the groups to determine whether they'll try to block the sale in court. Beshore's announcement largely upheld an earlier decision by Forest Supervisor Forrest Cole. Several other groups protested the timber sale decision but did not sign on to SEAC's proposal. Greenpeace, the Sitka Conservation Society, the Tongass Conservation Society, and the Juneau Group of the Sierra Club also say they're weighing their legal options. The logjam sale is slated for an area near Sweetwater Lake between Thorne Bay and Kaufman Cove. Lindekugel says that's a critical habitat area.
The record decision offered too much timber in areas that we thought were really key, and the fish and wildlife biologists think are really key for maintaining connectivity between the north and south ends of the island, connecting large blocks of old growth through a pretty heavily developed area with a lot of clear cuts and a lot of roads.
The regional forester's decision suggests some changes to the logging plan. Massey says they include directives that meet some of the environmental group's concerns.
Those instructions basically tell them to go in and mitigate effects of some of the roads that were scheduled to go in there by modifying some of the road standards, to defer some of the timber harvests in some of the key wildlife corridors until they could take a better look at them, and to continue to emphasize young growth, or what we call second growth projects. That means move more out of quote-unquote old growth over into some areas that have been cut already that are close to being ready, and see, and make sure you can do that.
The sale could provide timber to Klooks Viking Lumber, the largest operating mill in Southeast Alaska. The Forest Service plans to offer the sale as soon as October 9th, which could allow some logging before winter shuts down operations. In Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
The Rural Action Subcabinet is putting together schedules now for future public meetings in rural communities, looking for ideas and suggestions from local residents on how to improve conditions there. Attorney General Daniel Sullivan says the first trips to Unalakleet, Nome, and Kotzebue proved the public has a lot to say, with high participation in meetings lasting several hours in many places.
The benefits that we've seen in terms of ideas already from opening the process up are very apparent. And I'd also like to mention, we actually had a meeting of the rural subcabinet just a few days ago with a number of the commissioners who are on it. And there is a strong interest in not only continuing but accelerating these kind of visits to rural Alaska with a number of the commissioners holding the kind of town hall meetings that we had. So we are all working to coordinate our schedules and accelerate some of these visits.
The subcabinet will deliver a finished report to Governor Sean Parnell in December, setting out plans for improvement. Sullivan says he was most impressed with the public's input on public safety concerns, on alternative energy, and on technology helping with the delivery of services.
Whether that would be in the area of telemedicine, whether that would be in the area of education, law, and the use of technology in terms of the court system. There was ideas that we were hearing about in several different areas on the potential for that that I think we're really just scratching the surface on.
He says an interdepartmental task force headed by Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell will address the short-term needs for this coming winter in rural Alaska. He says it will focus on food and fuel and involves input from every village or community in the state.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Juneau Boys and Girls Club is closing its doors today, one of several across the state that may fall victim to a loss of federal funding. The Juneau Clubhouse threw a goodbye party for the nearly 60 youth and volunteers who hang out there after school. Most of them are low income, says club manager Tara Lee Ellis.
You know, this is a low-income community and place that we serve, and the kids that we serve here are welcome to come, and they don't have to pay very much money.
Boys and Girls Clubs of America sponsor more than 4,000 clubs across the country. 45 of them are in Alaska. Nationwide, membership dues average $5 to $10 a year. The clubs depend on federal and state grants as well as local support. The U.S. Justice Department has eliminated a $2 million grant that is passed through the national organization. Juneau manager Tara Lee Ellis says she just got one day's notice about the closure. Alana Humphrey is Chief Operations Officer for Boys and Girls Clubs of Alaska.
None of us had much notice. We have been working for the last about 10 days trying to secure extra funding. Everybody was notified last Friday that there was a serious concern.
Humphrey says 15 to 20 Alaska clubs will be shut down and staff laid off, at least temporarily. These are the clubs, like Juneau's, that are heavily dependent on federal grants.
As soon as we can fill the budget gap left with the loss of this funding, you know, we're looking to reopen clubs as soon as we possibly can.
The staff is small at most clubs, which rely on volunteers. Humphrey says Alaska Boys and Girls Clubs will remain open in communities where funding comes primarily from individual and corporate donations and grants. As Congress hammers away on health care legislation in Washington, Democratic Senator Mark Begich is heading to Alaska to host town halls on health care this weekend. The open events are in Anchorage tonight and Fairbanks Saturday. Town hall meetings across the country have been rancorous and intense, and Democrats have especially gotten hammered at events where anti-government, anti-health care reform activists have shown up. Begich says he thinks a lot of that was because of the heightened focus and media attention on health care during August.
I think my town hall meetings will be an interesting measuring stick of kind of reality, you know, if you feel about positive or negative about healthcare, you're going to come out to this town hall meeting because we're not out there on a national level like they were in August promoting everyone to come out on either side. It's just, here it is, opportunity. So I get a mixed view.
Senator Lisa Murkowski hosted town halls in Alaska in August, but Begich held some in the state more than 2 months ago. He says at earlier events, he heard from seniors afraid their benefits will be cut, small business owners worried about covering costs, supporters of the single-payer system, and those who don't want anything to do with it. Begich says people opposed to the Democratic-led efforts in Congress sometimes tell him government should completely get out of the health care system.
I asked him, does that mean you want to get rid of the VA system, the Medicare system, because those are all 100% government? And then when you have that discussion, suddenly the tone changes, and then they get into the fiscal component, which I agree with, that you have to have fiscal constraint on this, the deficit's growing too fast, and that's really where that kind of discussion goes to.
Begich signed on to a letter last week from moderate Democrats calling for the Senate Finance Committee to reduce the cost of the bill it's currently marking up. He and the other moderate Democrats aren't yet committing to any of the plans on the table. Most people come to Unalaska for jobs. Others come to visit historic sites or see wildlife. But two Germans came because they won an online contest from a throat lozenge company. KUCB's Ann Hillman got their story.
Christopher Ledwig says Fisherman's Friends lozenges advertise themselves as the strongest throat lozenge out there.
And they have a slogan, it's kind of, if they're too strong, you're too weak. And they come up with all this strong, being strong competitions, contests, whatever.
After participating in one of their events, he learned about their newest contest, win a trip to experience one of the toughest jobs in the world, crab fishing on the Bering Sea. Though Ludwig and his friend, Michael Hazel, had never seen the deadliest catch, they joined about 4,000 others and entered the online competition.
He had to say, what was the hardest job you've ever done?
Yeah.
And I think we had this smuggling bananas from the eastern part of Germany or whatever, where they never had tropical fruits.
They also offered to cut off their legs to go. In the end, it came down to a lottery between people who received the most votes. They won, but they didn't know what they were getting themselves into.
Pretty much all they said is like 10 days, two guys, 5,000 euros, and go for a really tough job far away.
Because of insurance reasons, the company couldn't actually get them onto any fishing boats. In the end, the company didn't arrange anything other than their plane tickets. They gave the pair about $8,000 and sent them on their way. With the museum conference going on, they couldn't get any lodging. Hazel said they came up with a contingency plan.
So we said, we just packed a tent. I thought, well, that'll be okay. We'll find something. It'll be okay. And anyway, so we arrived without any hotel book for the first night, and our bags didn't get on the plane, so we didn't actually have our tent either.
A woman at the airport helped them find lodging at a Macnac camp for a night before they could get into an actual hotel. Then they had to find something to do, since the only charter boat operator was actually off the island.
We just went to the pub and met some people and said, you know, we really, really want to get on a boat.
People hooked them up with a boat ride for early the next morning. After they convinced the captain to take them with him, he didn't exactly know they were coming. They hopped onto the boat, a bit unprepared.
We're not going to make this. We just had no food with us, no drinks with us. We just went on that boat. We're kind of scared. It was dark and cold and just got on there. And then we had a good time. I mean, we had a few hours of bad time as well on the boat.
Other community members took them hiking around the island. They said they loved it.
Oh, it's great.
It's great. It's wild. It's cold. There's lots of tough people living out here.
Yeah.
That are doing some pretty crazy jobs as well.
Just like they love their trip sponsors.
I mean, do you use Fisherman's Friends?
Well, of course I do. I love them.
are you a user of Fisherman? Yeah. No, we eat them. They're good.
Yeah, they're very popular. Yeah,
no, they're delicious.
And while they may not have experienced the true deadliest catch, like the contest promised, they did experience the true Unalaska. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Elks National Foundation, in conjunction with the Alaska State Elks Association and local lodges, is offering the Most Valuable Student MVS Scholarship for high school seniors. These scholarships are awarded to graduating high school seniors through a local, state, and national competition and are based on scholarship, leadership, and financial need. Information and applications at elks.org/ENF. Application deadline is November 2nd. This message sponsored by the Alaska Elks Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.